And we're back here in Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we have on the line Max Haven, and he is an assistant professor of art history and critical studies at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. He is also the author of Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, and an upcoming journal article, or a very recent journal article, The Creative and the Derivative, Historicizing Creativity Under Post-Bretton Woods Financialization. So, Max, we're very pleased to have you on the program today. Thanks very much for being available.
Thanks for having me.
It's not the first time you've been, of course, present. You've been part of activism and activity in academia here in Hamilton. You've helped enrich the community here. We've broadcast not only interviews with you, but some of the speeches you've given at protests, like the one for Colin Powell way back when.
Yes.
That's a popular one. People still watch that on YouTube. yeah, I mean, Max is a part of the community in Hamilton, even though he's not always here. He is contributing, and, you know, this is part of what we do in community radio, is recognize these ongoing contributions by artists, academics, authors, activists. And, of course, a lot of Max's work is about that subject as well. And, you know, Max also gave a TEDx talk not too long ago. It was called The Debt of Creativity. I have to say that that's one of the only TEDx talks worth seeing, if you ask me.
I'm
a little biased against them. But that was actually, I mean, you sort of, you challenged the audience quite frequently on the entire basis of the talks and everything else. It's about imagination, about creativity, all of these buzzwords we're all supposed to adopt, but what do they mean, and how are they being used? And I like the way in the TEDx talk you highlighted a wonderful painting by Gustave Courbet. It was himself painting, I believe. He was surrounded by the community and helpers, and I think it goes to show that things are not created in isolation. Finance increasingly recognizes that, but its own perverted way, of course, and we'll be looking at that. You know, There's a number of subjects to touch upon, but when we talk about creativity, and it's something you address in the larger works, where does this term come from? We've all adopted it. How long have people been using this concept of creativity?
Yeah, it's got a very interesting history. You know, we tend to think of creativity nowadays as some deep facet of our human nature that has been with us forever, and as a result, it's, you know, we imagine that people have been talking about creativity for, you know, ages, but in fact it's not true. The term only really becomes widely used in the 19th century, around about the time of sort of the romanticist and romantic art movements. Before then, really, most artists and authors wouldn't really have considered themselves creative. Shakespeare, for instance, I think only uses the term or one of its derivative terms a couple of times. You know, someone like Chaucer or even some of the early authors would have never used it. It was generally reserved for talking about the creative force of God, his creatures.
Yeah.
So it's not a term that was used, and it sort of came into the vogue in a time when really the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, was looking for these iconic works of great artists to collect, to sort of prove to themselves their own moral worth. So you get this idea of the creative genius as the creator of a distinct work of culture, this sort of enlightened, ennobled individual who, out of the chaos of the world, crafts a work of beauty or skill. So it really only starts to emerge 250 years ago in a real way that people would understand it today.
Yes, it would seem that, you know, the bourgeoisie were nouveau riche in a way. They were new money. They didn't have the cachet of the nobility, and they needed to show that they were special in some way. They could commission artworks, and artworks that showed that human suffering, you know, had gone into that, and they got to categorize the artist in a certain way. You know, I mean, art, it's obviously a subject that's close to your heart. There's this relationship between finance and art that you explore continuously as a theme. Your own institution, the College of Art and Design in Nova Scotia, it's always under the threat of imminent closure, like so many institutions that perform a public good today. This is because of this neoliberal logic that you very clearly discuss, and art and culture are worth only what, you know, people are willing to pay for them. You know, so the thing is, you look at the underfunding of art in the university sector and other places as something that hurts art, but can we rely on the market maybe to produce more art?
Well, I think defenders of the free market would suggest that we can, and certainly, you know, I think that the artistic impulse is a major part of the human experience. So, even if we descend into the barbarism of a totally market-driven society, we'll still have art. It's a question of who will have the art and what art will be for. If we leave art creation merely to patrons who are rich and powerful, then we'll get art that reflects their desires and the way that they would like to see themselves. If rather we fund art and support artists as a community and as through state-funded policies or through community arts initiatives, then I think we'll see a very different art. And we'll also have a very different vision of what the artist is. I mean, right now the artist is sort of held up as the perfect economic actor, as the idealized entrepreneur, you know, who goes out there and with individualism and sense of competition and drive creates, you know, order out of chaos. I think there's another vision of the artist out there which sees the artist as a critic of society, as someone who has a vision that can help transform society, and also someone who can bring us together in ways that we might not have imagined or might not have immediately felt comfortable about. I think the problem that we see today is that everyone wants to assign a value to art, and often an economic value. And really, art's real value, at least to my mind, is its ability to sort of challenge what we think is valuable, to challenge the entire order of value and how we imagine who and what is valuable in our world.
Well, this cuts right to the issue of creativity. I mean, you know, what is creativity used for, or who does it benefit? And it seems that there's this, always a dichotomy in what you're looking at in all of your articles and presentations. There's all sorts of dichotomies that are occurring. And, you know, one of them is between those who can use creativity and those who cannot. And in a sense, in our daily lives, we all are encouraged increasingly to use creativity as our lives become more financialized and more liberalized. So, I mean, how does that work? It seems that it's tied to survival strategies in terms of our personal lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that what has happened is that as the neoliberal paradigm deepens and has entered into this phase of sort of reckless austerity, we're beginning to see that so many of the sort of supports that used to enable us to live our lives, whether that was subsidized education or free or socialized health care or any manner of other social services are being stripped away from us. And as a result, we all just have to become a great deal more creative about how we just get about the business of living. I mean, if you look at the sort of labor market trends, we can see that there's an increasing movement towards short-time, precarious, temporary, casualized employment, which means that people have to be very creative about just cobbling together multiple part-time jobs in order to survive, then let alone what happens if you have someone who depends on you because they're a child, because they're disabled, maybe they're an elder. You have to become creative again about how you're going to care for this person. And meanwhile, even as we've been all made to become coercively creative in this economy, there's another set of voices that suggest that, you know, it's really our fault for our suffering, and that we all just need to, if we were all just a little more creative, we would be more successful. So you get this sort of rhetoric that we're seeing the emergence of the so-called creative class, or that we're entering what Bill Gates calls a phase of creative capitalism. And the idea is that if we remove all the barriers to capitalism, if we open up all of society to capitalism, and this sort of neoliberal paradigm, then the system will become much more adaptive, it'll become much more productive, that'll raise the general standard of living, and it will erase these sort of old barriers, whether they're the sort of large, pedantic, paternalistic corporations, whether they're outmoded nation states, whether they're forms of religious doctrinaire and ism.
Yes,
all those things will be swept away by the new creative tide. But this is, of course, just a surface justification for really the deepening of a really horrific system, which in the end, I think, leaves very little room for real creativity. I mean, most people, even though there's more opportunity than ever to be creative with, you know, with our computers, with what we can do with YouTube, with the availability of art supplies, there's more opportunities than ever to be creative, and yet fewer opportunities to have that creativity matter. And no real creativity in the sense of how do we want to create a different society? How do we want to recreate our own society or our own lives?
Yeah, I love the way you put it. Essentially, we're being asked to exercise and apply our creativity in day-to-day survival. And this is as the welfare state evaporates, as they draw away from Keynesianism. So they associated Keynesianism and the welfare state with uncreativity. And they say, now you can be creative. You can be creative in clipping coupons, recycling clothes, finding freebies, you know, exploiting rules and laws, stretching dollars. And that's just in the survival part. Then in terms of finding jobs, we're all entrepreneurs now. So there's no such thing as a job. You're going to be doing project after project after project, selling yourself, looking all over the, you know, and that's in the in finding jobs. And there's not a whole lot of room left over for what we were taught creativity was in terms of art, and especially not in terms of creativity and thinking outside of the system itself. And it seems now that pathways are more narrow than before. And you tie this to the financialization of our life. So, you know, what is the relationship between art and creativity and the growth of financialization or finance as part of our economy?
Yeah, well, these are tied together, two areas that I've been researching for some time, and I feel I'm still at the very beginnings of exploring it, because they're not things you would think would necessarily fit together. I mean, I think on the surface, the reality is that for the last 300 years, art and the art market and the world of artistic production has been very closely tied to the financial sector, in the sense that, you know, if we think of the great works of the Impressionist artists in France, or if we think of the work of the American Abstract Expressionism movement, all of these very famous artworks, their patrons were the financial sector. They were financiers. So there's always been a very close relationship. But I think there's a deeper relationship, too, which is that financialization speaks not just to the fact that, you know, the financial sector now occupies this predominant position in our economy. I mean, it, by far, it's the most, on paper at least, one of the most productive sectors of the economy. Huge banks really run the economies of many nations in the world. Here in Canada, for instance, the banks are some of the largest corporations. So financialization, on the one hand, means the increasing economic and political power of financial institutions like banks, hedge funds, mutual funds, what have you. But it also means the way that the ideas of finance, the ideas of speculation, of investment, of maximizing returns, of leveraging, they seep into the fabric of daily life. So, for instance, reality TV now is filled with these shows about people leveraging their houses, making investments, you know, the savvy and cunning property speculator who goes out and buys a house for a cheap amount, improves it, and sells it on. Or we can look at the way that post-secondary education has ceased to be seen as sort of a public good that should be supported by the public and is now seen as a private investment. You know, every student is supposed to invest in their future by going into debt and so on. So this, I think, is quite closely tied to the thing we were talking about a moment ago, which is that we're living in this more austere, more torqued economy where we're all expected to be sort of cutthroat entrepreneurs competing with one another in every walk of life. That in and of itself has to do with the financialization of the economy, the financialization of culture, and it makes us imagine that creativity is simply a matter of this very limited notion of economic success, that, you know, if we apply our creativity to our economic well-being, then we'll be fine. But of course, that's not the case. The case is that most of us won't be fine, and statistically speaking, many of us will not escape poverty, will not escape precarious life. Most of us who are coming of age now in this generation will not be able to retire unless there's some sort of massive shift in policy. Post-secondary education will soon be costing multiple tens of thousands of dollars for students, and this crisis will continue regardless of how creative any individual is.
Well, you refer very depressingly to this dull economic compulsion we're feeling, but that's not the way finance sees it. They see this as very exciting, and they see their lives reflected in today's art. They know that finance requires innovation, just as capitalism does. Everything has to be new. You have to get rid of something, even if it works, in order to get something that works better for investors. And that's what artists are often in. They have to produce something new, right? Because if you don't, then you're producing something derivative.
Yes, absolutely. This sort of addiction to newness has really driven the production of contemporary art for, I would really say, about 40 years. And it's quite destructive, I think, because what it leads to is a sort of exhaustion or cynicism within the world of art. You know, I talk to my students here at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design who are very good, they're very thoughtful, they're very socially minded, but they feel a sense of utter exhaustion at this constant compulsion to produce newness. And that's what I think the financial sector really wants out of art. They in fact, you know, we think that what they want is this sort of conservative, old, stodgy art, you know, portraits and landscapes and, you know, things that look like old masters or nice pictures of flowers or what have you. But no, what they really want is the most cutting edge, the most new, the most provocative, even the most offensive art. And one of the flaws, I think, in a lot of artistic activism is to assume that we can take on the mantle of the old avant-garde, which believed that you could challenge capitalism and you could challenge the financier class by sort of shocking them and offending them. But I think now that class really does want to be shocked and offended. They want to be stimulated. Because, in fact, what goes on in the financial sector is, in some ways, very creative. I mean, what is a credit default swap? That is a figment of the collective imagination. It's diabolically ingenious, but it is a work of art in some senses. Now, I wouldn't take that metaphor too far, obviously. A credit default swap or a collateralized debt obligation is, as even Warren Buffett put it, a tool of financial mass destruction, a weapon of financial mass destruction. But on another level, there is a way that the financial sector is an amazing reactor of creativity, cultivating the most highly refined and the best minds of a generation at the top universities in the world in order to craft these new elaborate ways of spinning more money out of money.
The financial sector is a group that's hard to shock if you've seen some of the exposés of the bawdry things that go on. But, you know, even derivatives, they're not celebrated as much as some of the more creative things, but derivatives make money as well. But ultimately, it comes back to that divide again between people who are allowed to be creative and people who are allowed to be derivative. You've commented that we're told that we live in a post-material, post-industrial society, but of course, all that's because they hollowed out the economy and moved the industry somewhere else. So, you know, that materiality, that industry still exists, but the vision of creative work continues. And so there is a small group of people that are allowed to be creative in a certain way. And it seems most people aren't or are decreasingly allowed to be creative. So can you elaborate on that dichotomy?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think it always helps to take a sort of zoom out of our particular economic circumstances here in Canada or in Eastern Canada and look globally at the broader patterns, which are, you know, on one hand very difficult to see and on other ways very easy to see. If you look at who gets the sort of creative work, the people who get to be designers, the people who get to be artists, the people who get to be people, you know, inventors like Steve Jobs, most of those people are concentrated within the former colonist countries, the United Kingdom, the United States, here in Canada to a certain extent, Germany, Japan, what have you. And the vast majority of the world's workers are basically slaving away to produce what those other creative people tell them to do. So in fact, we have a form of almost creative apartheid on a global scale where you have a tiny, tiny fraction of the population who actually get to exercise creativity and see that creativity valued, and the vast majority of humanity who are simply enrolled in reproducing what, you know, the status quo and the system, reproducing the goods and services that then furnish this top, you know, not fraction of 1% of the global population. And yet amidst that, we're told that we're now entering this sort of post-industrial, magical post-industrial society where the creativity of everyone is going to be able to flourish. We're told that if we accede to globalization's demands and, you know, throw our borders open to the goods and services around the world and throw the world open to capital's demands, then we're all going to get this opportunity to, you know, one day be a rice farmer in a paddy in China and the next day be Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. You know, we can rely on our own ingenuity and creativity, and that will, you know, if they're of high quality and if we work hard, that will elevate us to this sort of magical position of being in that creative crust on the top of the global maelstrom.
You can see this division of creativity geographically in companies like Apple, and I know you look at that. And you give us names like Bill Gates, and of course, he likes a certain kind of creativity, you know, supporting microcredit and education reform that sort of institutionalizes marketization of personal values in those areas. When it comes to that, the economy, I also like to think of Amazon these days. You know, they've got some people that are developing very intelligent software to determine what people are going to want to buy and how much exactly to charge them. And there's a few people that get to do that and go from warehouse to warehouse, setting certain production processes up. But everyone else, I mean, the term being used for everyone else is human robot at those warehouses. And, you know,
they're actually called fulfillment centers in an Orwellian turn of phrase.
Well, you know, the way those places are run in Germany, I mean, it is very Orwellian from what I'm hearing. And even in the United States, they've created a market for it's some kind of giant unregulated labor market where they can hire you for 15-minute increments at a time. Mm-hmm. They tell you what they want you to do, and then you do it. And if they like what you do, they pay you. And the average wage is something like $2 an hour. So, I mean, there's this enormous divide in creativity within all the large companies that are creating the new economy.
It's very true, and I think Amazon is the great example here. And there's a number of things. As you mentioned, they have this incredible way of basically making humans like cogs in their vast machine and paying these very cunning ways of circumventing local labor laws to, again, really exploit people terribly in these fulfillment centers or warehouses, as the rest of us call them. But they have some other interesting things going on as well, which have a bearing on the sort of ideas of the creative economy. One of them is that they have a system called Mechanical Turk, which is very interesting, which is a system where you can basically, on the Internet, buy labor, buy the task, down to the micro level. So say you are a small software development firm and you want someone to bug check your new app that you've designed for the iPhone, you could go onto Mechanical Turk and basically post saying, I need someone to do 15 minutes of labor doing bug checking. And you would find someone, let's say in India, who would be willing to do that job. And in fact, the workers bid against one another to do that work for a lower price. So Amazon here is really at the cutting edge of parceling out, fragmenting that labor, and really trying to globalize what would have once, I think, been a high-skilled workforce, that is, computer programmers. This also applies to things like proofreading, to translation services, anything that can be done through an anonymous transaction between two people over the Internet. So a really cunning way of, again, fragmenting and reparceling forms of labor that are reminiscent of the things dreamed of by Fred Winslow Taylor, famous for inventing the discipline of Taylorism, which is the idea you'd break down work tasks into tiny little chunks and get sort of replaceable workers to do that work, but going well beyond that. And the other interesting thing about Amazon, I think, is that they're at the forefront of also trying to take on the publishing industry. So now they offer an incredibly powerful and sophisticated array of tools for authors of any caliber to self-publish their books, to be sold exclusively through Amazon's networks as e-books or as print-on-demand physical copies. But this is really taking a huge chunk out of the publishing industry in the sense that it becomes much more difficult for traditional publishers to publish physical books, to market them. It becomes more difficult for them to even sell their books on Amazon. Amazon really has a very ambitious plan to become the primary retailer and publisher, and in fact labor service around the world in ways that are very worrying. Because what you get in the end with this sort of e-book revolution where everyone's self-publishing online is problems for those of us who try and write books that are not necessarily comfortable to read, right? It's very unlikely that my book is ever going to become a bestseller. I work very closely with my publisher to try and promote it, to try and get it to audiences who might not know about it. I don't know if that would be possible with e-books in the same way. And certainly it gives a huge amount of power to Amazon. They claim they have no interest in censorship. They claim they have no interest in even the content of the book. They only care about selling it as this sort of digital object. I think time will tell. I mean, if, for instance, Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden wish to publish a book through Amazon, print on demand in this way, and it were to, for instance, run afoul of the national security apparatus in the United States, and that group wished to censor it and put the pressure on Amazon to do so, would Amazon stand by journalistic and author freedoms?
Well, I don't know. You tell me. Didn't they just come up with a contract with the CIA?
Yes, I believe they did. Yeah.
Well, I guess time will tell. how they handle situations like that. Certainly Amazon does see a book like a widget and they're able to undercut everyone else. I guess when the publishing industry is destroyed, maybe some of them can get jobs in the Amazon fulfillment centers. I mean, this is disruption, right? And they've privileged it to the highest level now. So, things that are not profitable or as profitable should be destroyed and they can be replaced, with something better. And you say that Bill Gates and others are telling people straight out how to feel or how to think about these things. I'm reminded of Thomas Friedman, because he was the one recently who said that the middle class should retrain and be willing to retrain itself every 4 or 5 years. Because in this globalized world, being mediocre, being normal isn't good enough. And you're going to be poor and you're going to deserve to be poor if you're normal. You need to excel and go beyond everyone else. So you'll need your creativity just to have some kind of job. So as we wrap up right now, what's your response to this idea that, you know, creativity should and can and only be used in that manner for individuals and as a survival or business strategy?
I would say Thomas Friedman in his own person is an excellent example of the way that creativity and hard work doesn't get you ahead. It's having the right friends in the right places and saying things that those friends want to hear. I mean, Friedman is constantly guilty of, trying to predict the next internal capitalist revolution before it happens and is wrong far more often than he's right. But in the end, I mean, is that what we want? We live now as a human species. By some measures, we are richer than we've ever been. We in Canada or North America live in some of the richest countries that have ever existed in the history of the planet. And again, rich by some measures. Obviously, if you measure by happiness, maybe not. And so now we're supposed to accept that we'll have a life of constant worry, a life of constant movement, a life where we can't rely on anyone but ourselves, a life where we will have to apply all our creativity and our energies to merely trying to maintain a job. Is that what we're going to settle for? And if that's not what we're going to settle for, then I think we need to think about creativity very differently. I think we need to think about what it would mean to be creative on a sociological level, on a collective level, and what it would mean to actually reclaim or build the sort of power we would need to actually be creative in deciding how we want to live our lives. I mean, the fact is people like Friedman are perpetuating their careers on the fact that they're offering false solutions to a wholesale collapse in the system that we're living in. It's an ecological collapse, it's a social collapse, it's a governmental and political collapse, but it's also a collapse of the human spirit. Is a collapse of things like creativity into the most rudimentary and really just sort of animalistic ideas of competition that can be imagined. And I think at a certain point, we have to say, no, we demand and we deserve something better.
Yeah, Thomas Friedman's giving us a spoonful of sugar to economic medicine can go down, right?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, in any case, I know you are highly involved with circles of artists, activists, academics, and so forth. I mean, the work you do integrates thinking. Partly your art is a reflection of nature, of course, but it is also new thinking based on engaging in all of these processes. So it's something that requires an entire community. It's something that requires constant effort and coming back to things. You need to be supported financially in many ways, and your time is very valuable. So, I mean, I'm glad at least you could come down here. You've got so many administrative responsibilities and in addition to the writing that you do, and it's crazy stuff, but the community can benefit from at least getting a slice of this, and they can get your writings and other materials. I know the TED Talk, The Debt of Creativity, is available on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Your book, Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power, can be ordered, I imagine, from Amazon or similar retailers.
It can, and by Fernwood Publishing in Canada.
That's right. I often order from Fernwood. Imagine you have an academic journal article newly available for those that have access to such things. So there's a lot of places people can go. So Max, thanks very much, and just keep up the good work. Keep posting things on Facebook, and I hope people can access some of these resources. So thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye, Max.
Bye now.
And that was Max Haven, Assistant Professor of Art History and Critical Studies at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. I have to say, it can't be so bad having all of those fulfillment centers at Amazon. You can look up the article. I think it was Mother Jones entitled "I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave," but I don't know if that applied to Amazon specifically. But it's been commented on blogs like Naked Capitalism that, you know, we used to see the industrial worker as the epitome of de-skilling, that someone working on an assembly line was someone who was just doing the same thing over and over again. But of course, their movements were less regulated than people working in Amazon warehouses who have computers tracking their movements to ensure efficiency. So I guess one day we'll look at the unskilled assembly line worker as someone who had much more flexibility and input than the kind of jobs that are being created today. On the plus side, it does show that all of that standardized testing will have some kind of application in the real world after U.S. Students graduate from that system.